Welcome back, everybody. This is That's Criminal, and I am John Stamp. With me, as always, is the forever young Tiger Dog to my right, and he is already asleep. One of these days, I promise you guys, he'll contribute. He is an avid reader, or at least he seems to be an avid reader, because every time I sit down with a book, he decides to put his nose on my arm and nose right into it to figure out what I'm reading, and at the same time demanding I pet him. Which leads me to also believe that he thinks I'm way better at multitasking than I am, because he thinks that I can pet him and read a book at the same time, which I cannot do that. I've tried. Anyway, this week for me has been quiet because I'm editing, and it's always quiet when you're editing. That way the critics in your head don't have to yell when they tell you how bad your writing is. So yeah, editing. But on a positive note, with the editing, you might have noticed on my IG feed that I figured out how to make memes. I don't know how funny they are, but they made me giggle. So I found a new awesome waste of time to keep me from editing. That new skill set is a clear indicator of how much I enjoy this process. I think I'm pretty sure that I set a record as far as distraction goes when I went searching for a meme generator, probably after 5 pages into my first draft. So that time suck right there pretty much says it all. And that being said, I know you don't want to hear me bitching about my writer problems anymore. So let's get to the good part. Tonight, I am welcoming back Matt Scott. Matt earned his bachelor's degree in political science and history from Hampden-Sydney College in Virginia. There, he had the honor of studying under former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, General Sam Wilson, the college's president, and the person who introduced Matt to the world of espionage. During his studies, Matt became fascinated by the CIA, read dozens of nonfiction books related to Middle East politics, spycraft, and the CIA's war against terrorism, tales of clandestine spies and double agents, and memoirs of former agency directors, which there are quite a few. Matt grew up in Portsmouth, Virginia, and currently resides in Charlotte, North Carolina with his wife. When he's not writing, Matt is a professional financial analyst and amateur dog wrangler. His dogs, 2 golden retrievers, Bruce and Walter. Interesting. So, Matt, we've got Surviving the Lion's Den, The Iranian Deception, and now the Ayatollah Takedown. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Getting into the Ayatollah Takedown. Great title, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it kind of feels like a little bit of a throwback, like an 80s action movie kind of title. And yeah. I only say that because I thought I had a great title for Blood Red Ivory. I wanted to call it the East African Smackdown or something like that. I think it was awesome. I thought it was awesome. And like the first thing I got back from the publisher was like, "Yeah, we're gonna change your name." It's like, thanks.
Okay.
I fully admit I suck at writing blurbs and I suck at writing titles. So I was like, yeah, you guys are the pros. Let's do this.
I honestly came up with this title off the top of my head. So when I got the contract for after Lion's Den, you know, the publisher told me they wanted a series. So I had to come up with 2 more titles right there off the top of my head. And The Iranian Deception I already had because I had already kind of started working on it a little bit. But the third one, I had no idea. So my agent was telling me, he's like, I need you to give me a title. So I just came in here into the library, and Brad Thor's Takedown was on my shelf. So I just said Iran Takedown. I want to do a book about, you know, regime change. So Ayatollah Takedown. There it was. No one argued. I went with it and didn't look back.
Yeah, it snaps. And the book, what a great, it's so hard in these interviews not to give stuff away, but, you know, the way you rounded out and closed, and not only throughout, you know, from the Lion's Den to, from Deception to Ayatollah Takedown, the characters that just intermixed with each other was a really good arc to watch. But I did notice on my notes, kicking it off with that torture scene, kind of it's you like to see what happens to the bad guys after they lose, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, you gotta have, sometimes you really just gotta grab the reader by the collar and just bring them to your face and say, look, this is what you're gonna be looking at. So I did kind of, I felt bad kind of at the end of Lion's Den, when I had Farad kick the one guy in the face, I really wanted to stick it to him a little bit more than that. I mean, I did have his own soldier shoot him in the face, so that was a little bit of a good measure. But I really wanted to do something more with him. So I after Deception, I left a cliffhanger of a little bit. I can't quite give it away, but there was a cliffhanger, and it was not just about Farad. It had to be about the president of Iran. So I had to bring him back, but he had to atone for his mistakes, because the supreme leader, I really had to, if I'm going to take him down, I got to really build him up first.
Yep. The characters, they go through the paces. I don't think anybody makes it out of this unscathed throughout the story. And it's the characters that you've gotten to know, that you're seeing the consequences of their actions, as everybody's got to pay, everybody's got to pay the debt at some point. You're going to get caught.
And I think that's one of the good things about doing a series, is that you can take, the same characters you've used from previous books and, do new things with them. I mean, that's not to put down anybody who likes to do a lot of standalones. When you have a standalone, you're really starting from scratch. So you can do anything with them. The downside of that is you don't really know what you have until you're done. So for me, being able to, keep going with these characters until I feel like, they've dried out, was the best way for me to work. And, even at the end of this one, I still feel like those characters have some juice, but I had to bring it to, the conclusion that I really wanted to, I do leave it open a little bit. So to come back to them if I really wanted.
Yeah. And for everybody, the Lion's Den, it's it's got the characters kick it off from a couple different angles, everybody kind of meeting in the middle, but basically it's you already mentioned it. It's a coup for Iran. It's a three book arc of a new Iranian revolution, just to get everybody caught up. Great characters. We'll get into the characters in a second, but what you said a second ago, that's a gamble. Like, your Lion's Den's your first book, right?
Yeah.
So you've never written a book before, you're writing a Lion's Den, and you're just like immediately gonna be like, yep, everybody's gonna love this, and I'm gonna bet that they're gonna like these characters. I'm gonna go three more. Right, or two more. That's not an easy thing to do.
No, it was not an easy thing to do. And it was one of those, for me, it felt like those were the cards that I'd been dealt, even though I dealt them to myself. So I had no choice but to play them. And the only way to make people, keep coming to the table is to further develop them. So I had to make sure that, I loved them first, because, if the writer loves them, the readers are going to love it. If I do my job right, they'll love them too. But it was, you hit the nail on the head. It was a big gamble. And, even in this third book, with all the characters that I developed, chapter 33 is one of those chapters where, you've seen movies or read books where, the whole movie or book depends on whether or not you believe one particular scene. And it was a roll of the dice for me. And chapter 33 was that chapter. So I'm hoping that people like it.
Yeah. And can you go into that without giving it away? Because I'm afraid of spoilers. So
not really.
I know what you're talking about, but I'm not going to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't give away. I don't think there's any way that I can talk about it without giving away too much, but it is definitely the climax of the book. Everything kind of builds up to that point and, declines from that point. I know that's kind of a vague description, but when you talk about trying to write about regime change within the confines of one novel, I didn't have another five to try and do this. I mean, the takedown happens within one. So I had to take it into one chapter, and I guess the only thing that I can say is the Ayatollah catches on to things, and he makes an attempt to right it, or to turn the ship back his way, and things don't exactly go his way because something very, very unexpected happens. I think that's the best way I can describe it.
And I am dying to mention that because I've never seen that used as a kickoff to a coup. But I guess we could say it's biblical.
That's right.
Leveraging like in reading and not to, I mean, everybody's gonna be like, what the hell are you guys talking about? But to make another point, I guess we can kind of talk research on this because the understanding of culture, government dynamics, and the different parties at play within the Iranian regime. How long did that take you? Is it the way you explain it? You get very procedural in a closed off foreign country's government affairs. And how did you go about figuring that out? And also having the confidence to be like, yep, this is how it's working.
A lot of it was curiosity, just because I've always been curious about how, you know, about the inner workings of Iran. When we invaded Iraq the second time, you know, under George W. Bush, you know, there was Bob Woodward wrote quite a few books about the invasion and, you know, lessons learned and what we did know, what we didn't know, and what we didn't know we knew, and things like that, you know, unknown unknowns and known unknowns. So I wanted to take, you know, the lessons that I learned from those books and try to apply as best I could to regime change in Iran, because we now know why so many things went wrong. You know, they tried to apply a very Western way of thinking, you know, Western philosophy to, you know, a people and a country that, you know, has their own, you know, they have their own way of doing things. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, if we're talking about regime change, that, you know, it was not going to be a book about, you know, oh God, we're invading another country. How are we going to do this again? No, I didn't want to do all that. How can we best do it the right way? And obviously mine is a very creative take on it. You know, if this comes to fruition, I'm going to be, I guess, the next Nostradamus. I don't know, but I have to look at it through a very creative lens, but in looking at it through a creative lens, I have to also look at it through a very, you know, logistical lens. And I think the word you use is procedural. And I think that's correct, because in order for regime change to happen in my novel, the way I describe it has to be believable. And then I can take the creative liberties that I want to, you know, where I can. So I think the biggest part of it came out of that. The other part of it was just, you know, I watched a lot of YouTube videos from Iran. You know, as stringent as the Iranian government is on, you know, Facebook and Twitter, Instagram and YouTube, they are very lenient on. So you can get a lot of videos, you know, firsthand, and all the cars these days have dash cams. And so you can really see what's going on there, what buildings look like, you know, how people, you know, are feeling. You know, there's a lot of good documentaries on Amazon Prime. So I watched those, and, you know, I can't really give you a time frame of how long it took, but, you know, I tend to remember things that I see and read. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff, you know, going on upstairs, and, you know, I was able to bring it all together, and then I just put them all up. I put everything on paper, and then I just started weeding out the things that I knew wouldn't work. And I kept the things that I thought would. And, I guess that was probably my one cutting room floor, is that if I needed something else, I could probably go back to that. But otherwise, when I write a chapter, if I delete it and I decide it's not going to work, it's gone. I don't go back to it.
Yeah, I've got an extra file on my manuscript. So when I'm in Scrivener, and if I've got something that's just not going to hit in the plot, I'm like, that's kind of cool, I'll just drop it. And I'm like, maybe I'll come back someday.
Right.
But it leads me to another question. When you're writing your first draft, are you writing it and researching at the same time? Or do you have enough story in your head, you're just plowing through and then going back and figuring out the stuff you don't know afterwards?
A little bit of both. I won't start writing it until I feel comfortable enough with the research to write about it. But if I need, you know, some finer details to be correct, I definitely stop and look at it, go through it, and I pick the chapter back up. It's not one of those. It'll all be done in the same day, though. I have one hard and fast rule: is that when I start writing a chapter, I do not stop until that chapter is finished. So if it takes me longer that day to write that chapter, so be it. But I am not satisfied until the chapter is complete when I get up from that chair, because it's too hard to put something down and go back, because those juices have to stay flowing. And for me, it's chapter to chapter. Some people can write 300 words a day, 500 words a day, and if that works for them, totally fine. I'm not here to judge, but for me, it's got to be a chapter a day. And if that chapter is 700 words, that's fine. If it's 1500, if it's 3000, that's fine. But I just cannot stop in the middle of a chapter. I just can't do it.
Wow, that's impressive. Even with a day job. So we're all shuffling around, yeah, trying to make time where we can, and you're just like, nope, this 4,000 words is getting done today. I don't care.
And it's there were a lot of late nights, because I was working during the day. I'd come home, have dinner, or I guess go downstairs now, have dinner with my wife, watch some TV with her, talk to her, play with the dog, whatever. And then, my wife tends to fall asleep on the couch, 9 o'clock, 9:30. And then I'll just come upstairs. So if it's, a light chapter, I'll probably get done around, 11 o'clock, midnight at the latest. If it's a longer chapter, it's, 1-2 o'clock in the morning. But, and the next day, I'm not exactly the friendliest person in the world, but, like I said, I just won't stop.
Yeah. Box checked. See, I have the movie playing in my head. So I get only a certain block of time per day, and I get that 500 words, and then I press pause and come back. And I do think I suffer, though. I mean, you do suffer sometimes, because who knows what variables come into play, who knows if you make it back, if kid gets sick, you don't get the write for 3 days. It's definitely encapsulating it and keeping it all fresh is probably the best way to go. I just haven't figured out how to parse my time that way. Question though. I don't know. Same thing. Wife falls asleep on the couch all the time. But the thing that puts her to sleep the fastest and like the most peaceful is like true crime slasher documentaries. I don't know if you got the same thing at your house. I don't know what it is.
She's big on the Dateline, Dateline stuff, and a lot of the, what is it? The ID channel, I won't necessarily say it puts her to sleep, but once she sits down on that couch for the day, because I hear her on the phone. I mean, she's on the phone all day. So once she sits down on the couch and her body decides that this is all I can take for the day, it doesn't necessarily matter what's going on. But if I need to, between you and me, if I need to get a little extra work done, maybe I'll put on something that she doesn't necessarily like, and she'll just kind of drift off a little early, and then I can sneak upstairs and write for a little longer.
Yeah, between you, me, and a couple thousand people.
That's one of those husband tricks. We got to try from time to time, but it's harmless.
Yeah, it's just funny. I was just looking for some spontaneous marriage advice, because if I'm like Halloween Ends is out, and I'm like, I think we should watch Halloween Ends tonight. She's like, that's disturbing. I'm like, okay, what about the Green River Killer? Perfect. I'm like, okay. I'm like, however that brain works, man, you just keep rolling.
Yeah, whatever. And on that note,
sleeps like
I'm just gonna pop this in. I was so excited for Halloween Ends, and what a miserable, worthless movie that was. I was so unhappy when I left or stopped watching. I can't remember if I saw it in the theater or not, but I was so unhappy. I wanted to cause a mutiny and a revolution of its own to like just wipe that slate clean and bring Jamie Lee Curtis back for one movie and do it right. I was so unhappy.
I'll tell you, I have a caveat with that one, I swear I didn't say that movie on purpose. Did you make it through the first 10 minutes?
I made it through, but I was wondering what the hell was going on.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a part where they've got this couple in a red Jeep, and they're dead, and they're shooting a crime scene, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And 0.2 seconds of that scene, you've got me shooting from the side, snapping pictures. I got to be the crime scene guy in a Halloween movie. It's like,
get out of town.
Nine hours of my life I'll never get back. But it was Will Patton's running lines behind me, and I'm just stumbling over the scene, messing everything up. Yeah, it was. But I was like, there I am. I had to pause it real quick and like rewind, because It, literally, like if it's 2 seconds of that movie, I'd be amazed. But I was like, that box checked.
That is movie. That is awesome. That is something to be proud of. And I hope you're not mad at me for just going crazy on the plot of the movie, because that's something to really be proud of. But I
100% agree with you on that. It was like, guys, can we all just go back and watch the first one?
I mean, I just don't
wrap it up like the first one. You never even saw him in the first one. You didn't see hardly anything. But in this one, it's just like, come on, dude, the guy's hiding in a sewer. Like,
yeah, I mean, he's losing a fight to a 17-year-old kid. I mean, and he's killed all these people. I mean, I just don't know what was going on, you know, in the production room, in the script room. It's like, I mean, because if I had read this, I'm like, what in the who? Don't get me started. I'm going to start off on a rant here because it was so bad.
It is funny though. Once we got to set, I'm like looking at it, and the guys in the background, the cops and the uniform cops in the background are all cops that were just all extras. And the Moore girl, she was a cop also. And as we're looking, we're like, why are these people shot? This is a Halloween movie. But then at the same time, all these cops get together and we're looking, and they're like, yeah, that's almost a contact wound. That's a distant shot. The pox in the windshield don't even remotely line up with these things. It's like,
yeah,
we just started doing our thing, but nobody.
Yeah.
We're extras. They're like, hey, shut up, stand over there. But I did like that they kind of, and I don't care if it's a spoiler, but to throw a guy in a grinder is like, okay, maybe he won't come back. Maybe this is actually the end of this little franchise.
Yeah, I think that's the only way that could have ended. But I mean, it was so abrupt, and there was no fight between Lori and him at the end, really. I mean, not really. I mean, but what they had wasn't even believable. I don't know.
Anyway. They don't make them like they used to. That's why I think Amazon Prime is the last great bastion of cinema, because you can get all those old 80s horror movies and comedies and action movies that absolutely would give people strokes and turn hair white if they saw them today.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the funniest. Sure. It's the funniest, best stuff on TV. And it was made 40 years ago.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yep. No. Nobody lets me write movies, so. All right, so let's get back to talking about geopolitical issues.
Yeah.
I did, just keep it a little bit with your research. There's points in the book where they're discussing, you know, how do they go about running an operation and keeping control of these areas, running a purge on certain groups. And the discussion comes into the fact that sanctions have strangled that country. So it's just interesting when you start pointing out all the different mechanisms, the illegal mechanisms they're using to keep their country afloat and basically just maintain power. Was that kind of the same thing, just digging through research to find plausible tracks? I mean, everybody knows that they're into the human trafficking, the weapons trafficking, the oil trafficking, all that stuff.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was part research. It was part, you know, my attempt, you know, for, you know, the protagonist in my novel, Ben Thrasher, you know, and Beth Jenkins, to, you know, take an honest look at Iran and say, and think of the things that people did not think of when we actually invaded Iraq. So I just want to try and cover all bases as best I could, in terms of the sanctions, I mean, we really had the chance to put, in real life, you know, put our foot on the throat of the Ayatollah government, you know, right as Obama was taking office. And, when he released those funds, I mean, I just couldn't believe it. We really had a chance to do something, and now we're kind of back to where we were, you know, a few years ago or a few years prior to that. So, you know, I just wanted to take a good look at it. So with the economy and the way the things work, I mean, I just wanted to make it clear that, you know, the black market runs that place, and, you know, how hypocritical the Ayatollah government is in terms of, you know, wanting things that keep the people happy and keep it running, but at the same time saying, no, you can't do that. And that's why, you know, I really went into the research that I did for the internet in Iran, because, you know, the stranglehold they really have on the viewing restrictions, because it plays such a big role.
Yeah, I remember that that uprising they had right as that transition to office took place. And you know, the last thing anybody needs is one more front or one more, you know, hornet's nest to kick over. But at the same time, the Iranian people have always been so Western. They like everything that we not always are, but they like the lifestyle, they like the culture. It's that small group in control that's always screwed everything up. And I remember thinking, if there's any time to start funneling money into groups in Iran, that would be it. But at the same time, you're like, well, we already have two going. So how many, how much democracy do you push at any given time? But it was such an opportunity you lost.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're going to push money into it, you got to make sure you get it to the right people. That's the problem. I mean, you can give it to the rebels in Iran, but the rebels in Iran aren't in power. You know, you have to, that's why, you know, my book, I thought was, in order for this to be plausible, there had to be a wizard behind the curtain, and it had to be someone that was in power who wanted it. So I agree with you. And I think it could happen. It should happen, but you got to have somebody there that wants it, that's in power, that wants it as much as the rebels want it. They have to want to do it right. They have to want to do it for them, not for their own reasons.
And that the inside track that you had is just such a nice little bit of intrigue, you know, just, you know, that bit of infiltration from within. It was a really nice mechanism. It played well with our operatives, with like Thrasher and Jenkins. Yeah.
Jenkins. Yeah.
I'm horrible with names, man.
That's okay. Yeah. No, I had to. Yeah, that was really important because, you know, Lajani, you know, my inside man, you know, on for the Ayatollah takedown, I mean, he was in Iranian deception, but, you know, we didn't know too much about him other than he had just taken over for the last guy that the supreme leader, the guy who's now the supreme leader, killed. So, you know, I purposely kind of hid him away a little bit. And just gave people just enough of a taste to him. But to do this, I had to give people, you know, the necessary background, because if they don't see him as, you know, he's not flawless by any stretch. I think I wrote a section about how many wives he had, and, you know, I don't condone that, but I mean, that's just the way it is over there. I mean, like it or not, that's just the way it is. But in terms of, you know, having the right background to be able to pull something like this off, I had to give people that background. So, and for it to work, you know, if the CIA operatives are going to be working with him, they have to be able to identify, you know, some of the missions that they've gone on and find ways to generate chemistry in order to successfully pull it off.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to talk characters, but you mentioned, you know, Lajani shows up in book one. Did you have him layered all the way through to his final crescendo, or was it just one of those things where you went back, and were like, all right, so I like the way when you finish Lion's Den, and start
hold on, John. Others. Yeah. Time out, real quick. You're gonna have to edit this real quick, because Lajani wasn't in book one.
Oh, I thought you just said he was in book one.
He's book two.
Oh, he got started it wrong. You said two. Deception, not Lion's Den.
Yeah, Deception. He was in Deception.
Right. My bad. I'll leave it. My screw up. but the same question applies. Yeah, I don't mind leaving my screw ups on there for thousands of people to see. But for some reason you said Deception and I was thinking Lion's Den. But the same question applies. By the time you were working on Deception, did you already have that plan for him at the end of Takedown, or was it one of those things where you went back and as you're mapping out Takedown, you're just like, yeah, I'm gonna pluck Lajani, I'm gonna run him through, and or was it already there from the start?
Honestly, I didn't know that I was gonna do it until the end of Deception, because at the end of Deception, he's a part of the cliffhanger. I don't want to give it away, but at that point, you know, I knew that I had to do something else for him, and he had to be my guy. In Deception, you know, he was definitely a bad guy, but he was kind of a side bad guy, just kind of doing the supreme leader's bidding. But you didn't have a reason to like truly hate him other than he was one of the henchmen. So by the time I finished Deception, I knew that I he had to be the guy. So, as soon as I finished Deception and handed it in, I was already starting to, you know, generate some ideas of what I can do with Aljani. I actually, you know, went back and forth between him and, you know, the Iranian president. I was like, you know, who do I want it to be? But, you know, when I took a look at when I did my research for Deception, you know, I started looking at, you know, the Valkyrie plot, you know, that the SS had against the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, if I'm going to do the same thing with the Revolutionary Guard, then having the president be the inside man isn't going to work. You have to have somebody, you know, who has firsthand knowledge of the Revolutionary Guard, how it's going to work, and what levers to pull. Because as the Revolutionary Guard has been really in existence, it's gained more and more power as the Ayatollah regime has gone on and on. So they are the ones that are in position. If there was to be a coup, it would have to come, I think, from that branch. So at that point, it had to be Aljani.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that. I just always like to hear the thought process of when that character's arc took off, like where did the inspiration come from? Be like, nope, that's my guy. He's going to be the one, you know?
Yeah. No, I was debating back and forth between Aljani and the Iranian president. But I knew, I think by the end, I knew that it had to be, but as you say, the president doesn't go unscathed. He got his at the beginning of the book.
Yep. Yeah. It's he definitely paid for it. So when we talk characters in this, there's, as the three books went through, you've got, you know, there's a couple, there's, I mean, a lot of them stand out, and, you know, you've got DeLang and Carruthers who kind of kick mm-hmm. off book one, both yep. very interesting characters in their own right. They have a good arc as they go through. Yep. And then you've got Thrasher and Jenkins, mm-hmm. Who kind of seems like they take over the operation and sure. going into Deception. So you've got the experienced CIA agent and the rookie and two sides there. When you're, now that you've wrapped it up, as you were writing this, are you looking at split offs or you know, branches for any of these characters to go off on their own, or creating, coming up, what's your next move with these characters?
TBD at the moment, simply because my contract with Speaking Volumes, my publisher, was for three novels. So it's gonna, and you know, when you sign over your contract, you know, they own the rights to the characters. I mean, that's just the name of the game. So yep. It'll kind of depend on, you know, how sales go and what I do, and whether or not I re-sign with them or someone else. I can say that, you know, I've got some ideas for, you know, a new series, two new series, really. I haven't really developed it much. It's just kind of spinning around in my head right now. But, you know, I left Takedown open enough that if I wanted to do something more with them, I certainly could. You know, when I did Lion's Den, you know, Ben Thrasher wasn't even a thought. But once I did it, you know, Kirk Carruthers, my protagonist in Lion's Den, I just kind of felt like, you know, he was on a quest for revenge for his grandfather. So I just kind of felt like his story was done. I could I have gone on and do more with him, but I feel like at that point, you know, a lot of authors, a lot of really good authors, you know, Vince Flynn, you know, Brad Thor, all those guys, you know, they take a character, they build him up, you know, he goes to the farm, he adapts, you know, he doesn't know things, he, you know, he adjusts on the fly, and that's not bad at all. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying those guys have done it. So for me, I wanted to take, you know, I wanted to finish Carruthers' story, and then I introduced Thrasher in book one, and then I just thought about ways to develop him. And, you know, by that point, he's already an operative. You don't have to see him as, you know, a young guy or going through the farm, although I do provide a little bit of background on it, but you know, that's not the, you know, I don't spend 100 pages doing it. So he's already at the table. He's already in the game. And, you know, I needed someone who really understood him. So that's why I did, you know, the Beth Jenkins character. She was kind of out of it a little bit, you know, in book two. So I really wanted to, people said that they really liked her. So I really wanted to give her, her due in book three, because, I think she had the props, and I talked about it a lot in books one and two, but you didn't get to see a lot. So I thought it was important to, you know, to have Thrasher and Jenkins finally work together side by side, because they play well off each other's strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, the energy of those two, that conflict, the contrast, I guess, more. I mean, they work together, but they bicker a little bit, like every couple should. but her energy's great. She's actually one of the main ones. I was thinking there's a future there, but business being business, you'll have to wait and see on that one.
Yeah, they're never far from my mind. You know, I fell in love with the characters, like I hope the readers will. You know, the writer has to love them first, and you know, they're always off to the side a little bit. I've never forgotten about them.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. So working on what comes next. There's all those business contract issues to think of, but. You sticking with the thriller genre? Are you thinking of stepping out? Are you thinking of trying something different? Or are you pretty much, this is my side and I'm sticking with that international spy thriller life?
Yeah, I think that's where my niche is. I don't see myself getting outside of it. You know, I got to be honest, I would love to write a good horror novel, simply because the idea of writing something that scares people to death just, you know, it's like oxygen to me. I mean, the idea that I could do that just seems so cool. I don't know how well, you know, I would pull it off, just because, you know, I so much of my writing is based on research of things that have, you know, actually happened or could happen. When you go into horror, there's always that bit of fantasy. So you never really, you're the one who's writing the rules, and you can bend them or break them as you please, but there's always a very careful balance, you know, with the readers, because if they play by your rules, then you have to be very careful what you do with them. And if you do something wrong, they're not going to forgive you. Whereas, you know, on the international thriller side, people watch the news, they're going to pretty much stick with it. I mean, you can come up with some good technology or creative technology, and they'll usually stick with you unless it's totally, you know, not plausible. But they can see enough on the news to say, okay, well, I saw this, so I could see this happening. You know, the horror genre would not be like that. You know, when you write something like Pet Sematary, you know, you're bound by the rules that you make. So I think, could I do it? Yes. Could I do it as fast as I've done, you know, the thrillers? I don't think so. That one would have to, I'd really have to crank out some creativity and channel my my inner Stephen King, which I would love to do. But, you know, I got to stay where, you know, I think I belong. I would definitely be venturing into different waters if I did a horror novel.
Yeah, the best horror is the stuff that is plausible, right? The stuff that becomes plausible, like not like Halloween or something, but. But Jaws, I mean, Jaws is a perfect example. You got,
sure.
You
know, yeah.
Jaws is based on a series of attacks by a bull shark in New Jersey in 1908. And
absolutely. And,
Benchley scared everybody out of the water for about 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. Yeah. And that was so cool.
And it still lives on today. My kid's reading Jaws as we speak.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah. But, nice. I will say though, that, there's a sick kick that you get when you run into somebody, whether it's a conference or out in the street, and they're like, yeah, they tell you that they had to sleep with the lights on, you know, after reading your book. Or I've had another person say they had to put it down and take a few breaths because of certain passages. And it was Shattered Circle and Inquisitor. But it's kind of fun when you know that you freak somebody out a little.
Like,
I don't know how balanced that is, but
It's one of those things when you meet them, you say, oh, I'm so sorry, but I hope you enjoyed it. And then you turn around and walk away and you just kind of pat yourself on the back and say, I did that right.
He's like, well, okay, I got one. But sticking within the lines of genre, when I lost my mind and did that high fantasy novel, that was hard, because you got to not only learn all the rules that go into writing like a medieval novel, but you got to stick with them. And the entire time you're just, you know, even the verbiage, you can't use, you know, the newest vernacular. You gotta just stick in that inside that realm. And
Yeah.
That's tough. I ran back to the thriller genre after doing that. I'd love to do it again, but like you said, I don't have time. There's so much research that goes into it, and you're just stuck
especially
with things.
Especially if you do something that's historical. I mean, it's got to be done. It's got to be done right.
Yep. Yeah. So I don't know. It's but yeah, it's always, I mean, you're at that point, you've got that three book series down, you're open to whatever comes next. So it's interesting to look. For me, I got to do a space opera someday. But like you, I don't want it to be like, wizards in space. I want it to be plausible, but fun, you know?
So right.
But it's another thing. You toss it around in your head and it's like, well, it's not as good as Star Wars. So why write it? <You know? laughs> If you can't rival Star Wars, I don't know. For me, I'm just like, if it's not as good as Firefly or Star Wars, I don't know if it's worth tackling. So I haven't gotten the right idea yet. Someday.
Well, I mean, the good thing you have on your side is, you know, Star Wars is, you know, as great as it is, it's got a certain amount of age to it. The Marvel era has been able to really keep people's interest because of the spinoff series that they have, but you know, even they're gonna run out of gas at some point. So it'll always live in infamy, but at some point somebody's gonna say, you know, we need to come up with something new. So, you know, why not you, man?
You would hope that somebody in Hollywood or Atlanta, I guess, the new Hollywood would be sitting around the writer's room, you know, and instead of having them, you know, kick around which series to reboot, they just, you know, start circling around Amazon and start looking for fresh ideas. But
yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm hoping will happen. I mean, at least with thriller genre, I mean, you've seen it, the success happen with, you know, Mark Greene's The Gray Man, the Terminalist series from Jack Carr, and now the Night Agent from Matthew Quirk, I think it is.
Fantastic. And, I mean,
yeah, all great series. So to me, you know, the thriller genre is, you know, a well that has, you know, or keg that really has been largely untapped that they really have the opportunity for. But, you know, the thing about it is that, you know, who wants to take the gamble? And Hollywood, you know, you guys, you know, so many, yep, pardon the term, chicken shit cowards that, you know, don't want to take the risk. Because, you know, whatever the budget may be, because these days, you know, films live so, you know, have a very short time span in theater these days. So streaming is really the way to go. And that's fine. But on the streaming service, you have to make, you know, up so much, you know, up front. And then you'll get a little bit more on the back end because people will stream in different times and, you know, and get their money's worth out of it later. But if you're a Hollywood executive and you put $200 million in, you want to try and get that money back as fast as possible. So there's a lot of pressure on them to do that. But be that as it may, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, someone will come along with the, you know, find the Lion's Den trilogy and see that they can make something. And I would take considerably less than, you know, someone like, you know, maybe a Jack Carr just to get it made. But, you know, Stranger things have happened.
And I think, I mean, look at the last couple of years. I think the mode itself has done so much justice to the thriller genre. I mean, if you think about, you know, Hunt for Red October, that when that movie came out, fantastic movie. And Patriot Games, fantastic. And that was Tom Clancy's amazing book, 700 page books condensed to 2 hours on film. Right. Can you imagine if we had the long form that we had for the Terminalist and for the Night Agent and applied to those books? And I mean, I know that we can talk about Without Remorse, but I don't even recognize that as being affiliated with the book. No. It was so awful. No. But imagine that great, honest writing, like they did, like, what was it? Antoine Fuqua who took over the Terminalist and applied that.
Yeah.
Somebody with that kind of caring for the authenticity of the writer's voice that they did with that series applied to Hunt for Red October over a 9-episode span instead of just stuck on that 2-hour block. It's fantastic. Yeah. It's a much better mode that's been
created. And it's one of the things that is changing for the better. You know, when Hollywood first started, you know, optioning books, you know, in a larger sense, let's just start with The Godfather. You know, when they did that, I mean, nobody wanted the writer of the book to be involved simply because, you know, the writer of the book was going to be too possessive over, you know, his own characters and things like that. Now, Mario Puzo, you know, wasn't like that, but, you know, over the course of time, even as good as, you know, Red October and Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger were, Clancy was listed as an executive producer, but, you know, he didn't do a whole lot. I mean, he lucked out in that respect, you know, that, you know, people wanted to try and stick to the book as much as they could. I mean, it didn't, you know, do it, you know, cover to cover, but I mean, by and large, they stuck to the novel. And then they just kind of got away with that. I mean, Clancy lucked out, you know, John Grisham, and for the most part has lucked out, although the Chamber was an abomination, but, you know, Rainmaker, you know, Pelican Brief, yeah. The Firm, you know, those were all did really well. So, you know, authors would really have to luck out. You know, Patterson, you know, really hasn't lucked out with, you know, the Alex Cross series. So, you know, I think as the comic book era has come along and they've decided to get the writers involved a little bit more, you know, it's really opened, you know, the Hollywood writers and the producer, you know, they've been able to open the lens a little bit and, you know, get some insight as to why this character would or would not do this. And, you know, you can't do it. There's certain things on movies that you just, or in books, you just can't do in movies. It just can't be done. Cause reading and watching are two different things. But, you know, I think the way Antoine Fuqua has, you know, utilized, you know, Jack Carr was phenomenal. And I think it should set an example as to how a series like that should be done. You know, Greeny, I think he was more or less involved, you know, with the Gray Man. I think they took a, you know, a few more liberties than, you know, the fans would have liked, but they got the spirit, you know, of the book in there. So, you know, you kind of go back and forth and you never know what you're going to get. But my perception is these days, if you keep the author involved, you know, to at least a certain extent, you're going to make a better series, a better movie. If you take it, you know, and say, okay, you know, head over to catering, we'll let you know when we need you, you know, the author is just going to be like, well, you know, I took my check. I got my money's worth, you know, do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
You know, I would certainly want to be involved, at least to a certain extent.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, Marvel and Star Wars, that those studios, and I know it's Disney, which, ugh, but, I mean, the Marvel studios created by the creators, which was a gigantic step, you know, letting the people who actually wrote the books and all that stuff be a part of making the movies, applying those was, I mean, that was a new way of doing things. And it's clearly, you know, they've crushed it. I mean, I think they got to come up with some new ideas, but
it's just a shame that it took Stan Lee 60 years.
Yeah.
To finally see that Stan. Through. I mean, he was in his 70s or 80s when. Well, the first Marvel movie was Iron Man, and
then
Captain America. Spider-Man.
Yeah,
but even
the Tobey Maguire ones, wasn't he?
Yeah, even the Tobey Maguire ones were, you know, a little bit off the mark from what he had written. But, you know, when they started with Iron Man, you know, they really started following, you know, the blueprint that he really wanted, you know, for forever.
No, yeah.
You know, when they did that first. You know, Spider-Man and, you know, Incredible Hulk series in the 70s, you know, it was largely, you know, true crime fighting, you know, fighting a guy that's robbing a bank. You know, they really didn't involve the other superheroes, you know, for the most part. And that's just the way it was viewed. And they didn't want to take, you know, the liberties and, you know, let's be honest, in those days, they didn't have the special effects necessary to properly put it on the screen. So, it, you know, whether it be, you know, the Marvel or the DC, you know, the digital age has finally brought, you know, the comic books to where they should be. But in terms of the creative voice, you know, involving the guys that, you know, that wrote the comic books was, I mean, to me, essential. And it could not have succeeded the way it has succeeded without them.
Yeah, it would have been nowhere near as successful if they had just put those guys on the sidelines. But
yeah.
But that's awesome. We've been going about an hour, but before we go, I can't stand the two terms, so I don't use them. But so when you're, as far as process, I don't think we talked about this last time, but I've done a lot of, I went hard on the fiction this season of the TCP. It was just what struck my mood. And there's been a clear delineation between people who just get an idea in their head and run with it. And I know that they call them pantsers, and I can't stand that term. So I'll set it for clarification. And then there's structure people who have to have a roadmap to follow. Which side do you fall on?
I don't think there's a term for me, because I'm more of a hybrider, if there is a term. I get the idea. What I'll do is I'll get the idea and I'll start working on the characters, and I'll say, okay, you know, I can do this with Lajani. I can do this with Thrasher, you know, can put, you know, Beth Jenkins in the middle. Okay. So I have, you know, a rough idea. And then I start sitting at, you know, with the plot and the characters and how I want to develop them. I will outline, but it'll be something along, you know, chapter one, you know, John goes to prison, and that's all it'll say. And then, so I'll outline probably the first 2/3 of the book that way. And then I'll leave it to the creative juices to actually write the full chapter. So I won't write, you know, a full on outline. I just know what I want the characters to do and essentially what will happen. And, you know, when I look at it and I do 2/3 of it, I always look at it and that's like, oh my God, how am I going to finish the rest of this? But as you start writing, you know, that's where pressure is a good thing. Because as you start writing, you start figuring it out a little more. So the last third of it always comes by way of the natural creative process. So I like to think of it as, you know, I have a roadmap. I know I want to go north, east, south, or west, but how I get there is, you know, totally up to me. So I can't see myself totally sitting down, just because I don't have the memory to be able to say, you know, what I was going to do in chapter 33 with this character when I'm only on chapter 12. I wish I could. If I was a, you know, an outliner or a structure guy, I think it would drive me crazy, because at that point, you know, I've written so much and then I got to go back. Now I got to go back and actually write 1500 words. That would be a recipe for me to tap into my lazy guy. And you can't do that as a writer. So, you know, having a small outline, a directional outline, I think is probably the best way to put it, is the way I go. And then I just say, I write a chapter a day, no matter what it is.
Yep. That's a good plan. I got to have a roadmap A to Z, but then my characters, you know, you said that the way the plot goes is all up to you, but my characters, I'll get about two-thirds of the way through and be like, we got a great idea, follow us. And so your characters don't just run off on flights of fancy while you're writing, or you get pretty good, you set the reins on those people.
Yeah, I pretty much know where I want to go. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that for the most part, when I start the novel, I know I want it how I want it to end. Maybe it's not exact, but like, I knew I wanted the cliffhanger at the end. I knew what I wanted to do at the end of, you know, this third one, the guy told to take down. And when I wrote Lion's Den, I knew exactly what I wanted, because that end chapter, that last chapter, when I started the first draft, it was actually the first chapter. So there was a little bit of a cutting room floor on that one. So, you know, when you know where you want to go, you know, when you can see, you know, Epcot Center, you know, in your sights, you know, how you kind of want to end it. So that helps. But yeah, I try not to let them, you know, tail off too much, just simply because I've done enough development to say, okay, you're only going to go this far.
Yeah. All right. That's a good way to keep control. Mine don't do that. I'm not not enough of a disciplinarian, I don't think. But man, I don't want to keep you too late tonight. So I'll just say thanks for joining me, man. And whatever you come up with next, we'll have to sit down and chat about it.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for having me back on, and hope to see you at BoucherCon at the very least.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And you guys, if you want to find Matt, he is on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Matt Scott Books, and his personal website, mattscottbooks.com, keeping it nice and consistent for everybody. So yeah, Go look him up. And the Lion's Den series is awesome. So Matt, I'll talk to you next time, man.
Thanks a lot, buddy. Take it easy.
All right. We'll see you later, everybody.